Risky business. Risky business. Risky business.
Hello, everyone. This is Risky Business, a show about bad people doing nasty things with evil technology. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is hosted by Vigabyte, but sponsored, most importantly, by Sophos. And you'll hear from Sophos's Paul Ducklin later in the show, and we'll be talking to him about form, and that's form with a PH. What is it with that substitution on bloody everything these days? This week's feature interview is with Chris Eng of Vericode, and we'll be chatting about his analysis of a nasty bit of BlackBerry spyware that was actually pushed out to all BlackBerry users on a carrier in the Middle East, in the UAE. It's a fairly interesting story. You may have caught it in the headlines over the last week. But of course, before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, there's a cop, the cyber cop, Brian Hay from the Queensland Police Service. He's proposing that the Queensland Police, Queensland is a state in Australia, he's proposing that they do a war driving exercise to warn people of the dangers of unsecured Wi-Fi access points.
Well, I guess this doesn't sound like an awful idea. I do wonder if this is the best thing that cops can be doing, but I guess, you know, cyber cops, they've got to do their cyber thing.
Yeah, I understand that it might not cure everything, but Brian is a guy who I've met several times over the last few years, and he's the sort of guy who, just because he can't cure the problem entirely, doesn't mean he's not going to try to just chip away at it bit by bit. And I think that's quite commendable, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think so too, and certainly there's, you know, plenty of people who have wide open wireless routers on their home DSL circuits, and, you know, it does expose them to a fairly high level of risk. But on the other hand, you know, I do wonder whether the time is better spent, you know, giving that to corporates. Like if TJ Maxx had been driven past by the police, maybe they would be in a better position. And I wonder if, you know, one policeman driving around with his laptop is really going to make a difference to a large corporate.
Well, it would if he stumbled across something like TJ Maxx, wouldn't it, you know?
Well, I mean, would it, I guess? I mean, they were, what, WEP encrypted? I mean, from his point of view as a cop, right, he can't go and bust into the WEP and decide whether or not that is actually a real risk or not. Whereas, I mean, the sort of stuff he's going to see is wide-open home networks, you know, D-Link, no password, and those are valid risks, but they're not the ones that are going to get, TJ Maxx-scale ownage.
No. This guy's been, I should mention, he's been running a personal one-man campaign against 419 scams in Queensland for many years. And his approach is really amazing. I mean, he really engages with the press. That's how come we all know him. And he's just been awarded by McAfee the International Cybercrime Fighter Award. So congratulations to Brian. And I fully support him in his war-driving adventures. And it's been really interesting seeing this, because one thing I've noticed is that on Twitter, people, some arse clowns, have been criticising him, going, oh, this is bullshit, you know, what are you doing? It's like, well, at least he's trying, guys, you know, like, give him
a
break.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, being proactive is certainly to be commended, you know, and I just think, you know, there'd be good, you know, good on him, more power to him, and carry on. I'd be interested to see what the results are.
Yeah, I mean, look, the critics have a point in that the results probably aren't going to be that tangible, but I think anything that raises awareness, if he's going to try, then, hey, good on him.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Now, anti-malware company is going to be thrilled to hear of this next story, because they've been predicting it since about 2001, which is finally, Adam, it looks like we've got some malware in the wild affecting Symbian-based mobile phones.
Yeah, they finally get their mobile device worm, and they will just be so happy.
Yeah, they're going to be thrilled. They're going to be updating their sales tables and saying, look, you know, we've got a business case now, and, you know, all of this technology that we developed like 7-8 years too early, we're finally going to be able to sell it, you know. Someone fire up the shrink wrapper, because we've got those boxes to shrink wrap. They're going to be so happy.
Yeah, they are. They are. Between this and the iPhone exploit that's due out at Black Hat, I think, you know, it maybe this will finally be the year where they get to actually shrink wrap their crap.
Yeah, you're talking about the SMS-based attack on the iPhone?
Yeah, the one that Charlie Miller dropped at SciScan a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and there'll be more details on that at Black Hat, won't there?
Yes, I believe he's actually going to release the code or working examples or something.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah. But no, it's interesting, the Symbian worm, because it uses a signed app distributed via SMS. And I think this is a great example of where code signing fails as a security technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that points to failure of PKI in general as a security tech.
Yeah, now this one's called the SexyView/SexySpace malware. And Trend Micro is saying it's a botnet, and F-Secure is saying, well, it's not really a botnet yet. It is malware, but we're not really convinced that it's a big deal. And it's interesting that you mentioned the code signing, because CNET has reported that the Symbian Foundation has actually come out and acknowledged that its process for keeping malicious apps off Symbian OS-based phones needs improvement, because they're signing nasty code, and that's not cool.
We all knew that.
yeah. But I mean, how does their key revocation work?
Actually, I don't know about the real options for revocation on Symbian platforms.
Yeah, me neither. But I mean, this is the one thing that strikes me, is I've heard of a few cases with mobile malware where it's all signed code, and any platform that uses signed code is they just haven't thought through the revocation stuff, and so it's kind of pointless,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, certainly putting apps through any kind of signing process in the first place and detecting the full set of capabilities is outside of what vendors are willing to pay to have their apps signed.
Mm.
And if you're trying to encourage a marketplace like Apple, right, you need to keep those costs down.
Yeah, you're talking about the App Store, or?
Yes, with the App Store.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, having a revocation process that works and that they're willing to use is a pretty important part of that.
Yeah. Do you know if the iPhone applications, can they be revoked?
I believe Apple have some kind of kill bit where they can turn off apps and stuff, yeah.
So it's not so much crypto, it's more like just we control the whole OS, so we can just piss off applications when we want to.
Well, that's kind of Apple's model, isn't it?
yeah, fully. Now, just in brief, there's been a zero-day released in Firefox 3.5. Now, it has been patched since this story initially surfaced. We don't normally cover vulnerability stories. The reason I mention this is just so that we know that this is a problem that's affecting things aside from Adobe PDF Reader and Microsoft Office. Yeah, because they've been getting hammered.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Firefox is a big and complicated piece of software, and I'm not surprised. I believe this is what is in the JavaScript parser again, was it?
It was the JavaVscript compiler, yeah.
I guess, it's good that it's been patched, and it keeps us, security guys who are used to being smug because we don't use IE on our toes, eh?
Yeah. Adam, this next story is a little bit offbeat for us, I guess, but it's a story about the shady world of pay TV piracy. Now, this bloke was apparently offered $250,000 to crack a smart card or something. Can you just explain this story to us? It's carried by Wired.
Yeah. So the a couple of guys ran a business importing and selling satellite TV decoders, and these typically can only receive the signals that are unencrypted, unless you have a smart card with the crypto keys necessary from your encrypted satellite TV provider. And now this has been an arms race for years between the satellite TV broadcasters and people who want to pirate their content. These are a couple of guys, and as part of their dealing with the fact their sales were going down after the latest round of encryption from the network that they were selling equipment to pirate, they engaged someone to crack the crypto. And I believe, they were offering a quarter of $1 million US reward to extract the crypto keys and the PROM from the smart card.
So I guess they were firing up the old electron microscope.
Well, apparently they bought the guy an electron microscope. He submitted an expense claim for $8,500 for an electron microscope.
And did they actually get there? I mean, how did this story come to light? There's been some sort of indictment or something?
Yeah, I believe the guys actually got arrested and they're being charged under the DMCA or something like that in the States.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as you said, it's a slightly offbeat story for Risky Biz. But I think what is interesting for us in the IT security world is that the pay TV arms race between the pirates and the broadcasters really is a microcosm of the security industry as a whole.
Mm.
And I think in the past compared it to it's sort of like the Japanese schoolgirls of the infosec industry. How Wired has a column saying what's hip with Japanese schoolgirls because that's what the rest of us will have in 5 years. Well, it's the same thing with these guys. And this is big money being spent to crack serious pieces of security technology, smart cards, using electron microscopes and etc. This kind of real targeted attack where it only takes, one well-funded attacker to break the whole system, that's, something that we're going to see more and more of as we progress. And so, seeing how the pay TV industry has dealt with that, I think, is instructive for us in this industry.
Well, I actually find there's one element to this story that I find deeply, deeply reassuring, which is that in order to extract encryption keys from a smart card, you still need to hit it with an electron microscope, which means, you know, doing attacks over the net and trying to grab someone's keys from some sort of smart card reader that's attached to their system. I mean, pretty much forget about that for the next, you know, I mean, theoretically, it might just not be possible with a standard reader to extract those keys. I mean, we could see some catastrophic attack that will mean that's no longer true, but I'm more and more confident seeing stories like this that smart card technology is pretty much the most robust second factor that we've got.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the design goals of the system is to be resistant to those sort of attacks. And, you know, in the end, it's 100% reliable on the cryptographic protocols and the systems they interface with. I mean, I've done some work recently on smart card systems, and, you know, whilst the crypto on the smart card side of things is particularly robust, you know, sometimes the systems that they interact with, you know, with the web apps and stuff that are used for loading up the cards and that sort of thing, right, those are the weak points instead. We don't have to go after the cryptographic systems.
But it's nice, isn't it, just to have one device that isn't a weak point?
Well, when you put it like that, I feel so much better.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, think about it. We've got the whole chain, you know, the security chain, and everyone goes, oh, you go for the weakest link. It's nice just to know that we have one link in the chain that's actually reasonably robust.
Yeah, like theoretical math. Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, yeah. But next up, mate, Microsoft has released a stack of code under the GPL. I think this is fascinating news.
Yeah, this is quite interesting, isn't it? They pushed about 20K lines of device driver code into the Linux kernel, apparently, all released under the GPL2 as required. Which, yeah, is certainly a bit of an about-face for Microsoft. Although, on the other hand, I think that, you know, maybe the fanboys and the you know, the license-ranting bits of the internet are making a bigger deal of this than is absolutely necessary.
Well, yeah, I mean, this isn't about them embracing Linux. This is about them taking direct aim at VMware and saying, we are going to eat your children.
Absolutely, yeah. This is about making their Hyper-V virtualization tech work, you know, well or better than VMware or Xen.
We should just backtrack for the listeners who aren't across this story. Microsoft has released a whole bunch of driver code that is designed to make Linux work with their hypervisor product, which is called Hyper-V. Now, of course, the big advantage of VMware is that you can use multiple OSs on it, whereas with Windows Hyper-V, you can until now just use Windows. So this is after this all sort of settles. You know, Hyper-V is going to start actually looking like a pretty viable alternative to VMware, which I'm sure EMC, which owns VMware, is probably not too happy about, because when Microsoft decides it wants to dominate an area, you know, there's a pattern, which is they release the version one of their product and everyone laughs at them and says, oh my God, that is so shit. How can you show your faces in public? Then they release the second version and people are like, well, that's okay, and it's cheap and it works and the interoperability is really good. And then by the time they roll around to the third version, around the fifth year that they've been doing something, that's when the baby eating and the wailing and the gnashing of the teeth happens.
Yeah, and we have Windows 3.11 and it's awesome.
Zing! So, yeah, look, that's interesting anyway. Not strictly a security story, but I just thought it was worthy of inclusion. Now, next up, Nmap 5.0 has been released. The most interesting thing about this I found, Adam, was that they've released the NCAT utility, which is like Netcat, but has all sorts of nifty support for things like IPv6.
Yeah, no, I had a brief look at the new Nmap release, and there are a bunch of new features in there that are worth playing with. You know, Nmap is one of the stalwart tools of the industry, and yeah, I would certainly recommend anyone who does scanning regularly to have a play with the new version. Yeah, the NCAT tool also is useful. I mean, Netcat is a very handy thing to have around, and you know,
it's getting a bit creaky these days, though, isn't it? I mean, Netcat's been around for a bloody long time, and it hasn't really been innovated.
The original Hubble one certainly is a bit long in the tooth, but there is a GNU Netcat release, which, you know, if you use it in Debian or Ubuntu or something like that, you'll be getting the GNU one, which has a few more features than the original. But, you know, it's good to see some development there, and I think the brokering mode is quite handy. That would be something I imagine I'm going to use fairly regularly.
Mm. And, of course, you know, Fyodor is the guy who maintains Nmap, and if you want to talk protocol stuff, like, this guy knows every single IP stack and every single little eccentricity and thing that's wrong in every single IP stack on every single OS. So you just know that when he does a major release, it's going to be good.
Yeah, and I've been playing with it, and I'm quite impressed. You know, for a .00 release, it seems pretty good. You know, I've done some scanning with it, and yeah, I'm quite happy. Actually, one other new feature that's worth mentioning is the visual network mapping tool that comes with the GUI now is actually, that's worth playing with.
ZenMap. Yeah, ZenMap's been around for a little while, and it's funny because he did a really good release of that a while ago, and no one really was using it because they didn't quite get it. So I think he's just bundled it up a bit better into 5.0. But ZenMap's been around for a while and doing very cool stuff.
Yeah, no, the mapping tools definitely are useful.
Final story for the week. Gee, what a long news segment we've had. I told you it was a good week. There's a Linux exploit around. The reason, you know, and as I said, we don't normally do exploit stories, but this one's kind of interesting because I believe it's a kernel bug that normally, like if it was compiled properly, it wouldn't actually be exploitable. But because of optimizations in GCC, which is, you know, the whiz-bang compiler that's used for these things, it actually is exploitable. Is that right?
Yeah, so this is it's an interesting example of a null pointer dereferencing bug. And if you read the source code where the bug is introduced, it looks just fine. And then when you compile it with a certain number of optimizations, the compiler will actually take out one of the guard checks that protects against the null pointer dereference. It effectively reintroduces the bug during the compilation process. And then, Brad Spender wrote an exploit that works on a bunch of different platforms and bypasses a bunch of different Linux kernel kind of security systems. Fully weaponized working local privilege escalation exploit.
Do you reckon we'll be seeing more bugs of this kind that have been introduced by compiler optimizations, or you think this is maybe just a full ninja one-off?
I think it's probably more in the ninja one-off category.
Yeah.
I mean, finding these sort of things is difficult. But on the other hand, I guess the fact that we are reduced to spotting bugs introduced by the compiler, maybe that says something about the quality of the core code these days. I don't know.
It's funny though, how would you find something like this? That's what I want to know.
Well, that would be a very interesting story, maybe. You should go hit up Spengler and see what he has to say.
Maybe it's like the scene in Back to the Future where the guy hits his head on the toilet, and comes up with the flux capacitor.
Yeah, I wish that happened when I hit my head on the toilet.
What did you do instead? Just bleed a bit?
Yeah, bleed on the toilet. That's not really a good look, is it?
That's pretty late. All right, Adam Barlow, thank you very much for joining us again for the news.
Thanks very much.
Adam Barlow there with a look at the week's headlines. Next up, it's time to have a chat with Chris Eng of application security company Vericode. Listeners may have spotted a story doing the rounds which described a somewhat odd situation in the UAE, or United Arab Emirates. Mobile carrier Etisalat sent out a network compatibility update via a WAP push, which was basically a BlackBerry application, and it went out to all of their BlackBerry subscribers, and it turned out to be spyware made by an American company called SS8. And that company, of course, makes lawful interception equipment and related software. So by the looks of things, Etisalat had done this so the government would be able to intercept BlackBerry users' mail. And that's a pretty neat trick. The company that makes BlackBerry's, Research in Motion, or RIM, is based in Canada. And all the email that BlackBerry users send is routed through Canada using TDS encryption. So try intercepting that. Of course, if they're using a BlackBerry Enterprise server or whatever, they can pump it out through their own systems, but just for a standard BlackBerry subscriber, it goes through Canada. Anyway, Chris was one of the first to have a detailed look at the BlackBerry spyware, and he joined me by Skype from the USA to discuss the code he dissected. I started off by asking Chris how the bad stuff got onto everyone's phone in the first place.
It was sent down, according to the people over there that reported this, it was sent down as a WAP push. So the user didn't go and initiate the download. They just got, I believe they may have gotten a notification on their device, like a dialogue. But basically, it was positioned as sort of a network compatibility release. So, you need to install this. The carrier's telling you need to install this so that your BlackBerry will be compatible with different networks, or so that it will ensure proper operation. Somebody had posted what the exact wording of that was, but basically it was positioned as a sort of a compatibility thing. So, as you might expect, I would imagine that most people just clicked accept and installed it. And then once it's installed, it's probably important to note that it does install itself in a sort of a non-running state. So off the bat, it's not capturing everything and forwarding it to the carrier. The code is there and it's resident and it's kind of in a state where it's ready to start doing that once it gets that signal. But right off the bat, it's just kind of installed there listening and resident.
Well, I imagine the reason that they would have done this is because the way the BlackBerry handles its communications is generally pretty good, but it also routes everything through Canada or something, doesn't it?
That's right. It's end-to-end encryption. So anybody sniffing the wire is not going to be able to do that. And so I think that's where this company that writes the software kind of gets that demand from, because if you're going to do lawful intercept on this type of device, it's almost like this is the only way to do it. You have to be, you know, at one end or the other, you know, intercepting that, because in the middle you're not going to be able to do that. Every device, you know, is going to have its own key, and you know, there's no sort of master key to decrypt all RIM traffic. Mm-hmm. So, but it, you know, it just doesn't come across very well, even though there's a good technical reason for it. Maybe,
yeah.
You see why that might not resonate very well with the users.
Well, I'm also wondering why on earth they had to update every single device with this. You'd think, if there was a lawful intercept issued, it would be possible for them to roll this thing out to those handsets. You wouldn't need to hit everyone at once.
You would think that was the case. Being the carrier, they should have access to, their subscriber database. They should know who's associated with each phone. And, when you provision a device, just like, you know, when I provision my BlackBerry Bold on AT&T, like, they know what the IMEI is and they know what the PIN is, which is the sort of unique identifier for each BlackBerry. So the carrier would know that information, and there's no reason why they couldn't have just pushed those down to individual devices when they needed to, and then specifically send over the code to turn those devices on. And in fact, that would have been a more stealthy way to do it.
Do you think this whole episode is something that's likely to damage RIM's credibility in some roundabout way? Because I know it was the carrier that did this, but people tend to regard the BlackBerry as a reasonably secure device. And here we have, you know, some telco in the UAE trojaning, thousands of the things in a single instance. Do you think this could really have some nasty effects for Research in Motion?
I personally don't think it's going to reflect that badly on them, primarily because they can go back and say, here are all the ways to mitigate against this. And the people that are really going to be concerned about this are the enterprises, because, BlackBerry is really picking up as a consumer device, but it really has its sort of sweet spot in the enterprise. And the enterprise, with all the devices attached to they basically communicate with an enterprise server, which is another product that they have. And on that, the administrator of that server can actually set different policies as to what users are allowed to do that are associated with that server.
So you could actually kill that Trojan with the BlackBerry Enterprise server, can you?
Right. I mean, they should be able to say, these apps aren't allowed, or you can even say users are not allowed to install apps. I mean, you can get pretty granular in terms of what your users can and can't do with their devices. So people from that standpoint have a good mitigation. Of course, people can always just go remove the application from their device too, which is what people were saying on the bulletin boards. They were saying, well, it's called registration, and just go into your application settings and just delete it. So people can just go delete it. It's not getting pushed down again. It's not persistent in any way. So there's a lot of mitigations against it. It's just the fact that you think of it as something that could have been a lot more stealthy than it was, and because the way that people recognized that this was happening, per the reports, were that everyone's battery started draining. And that was because, all 100,000 or so many devices were trying to connect to this server that was collecting the forwarded copied messages. Not because all the messages were being forwarded yet, but all the devices were doing this initial registration, just to kind of say, the software's installed, and here's my ID, for example.
Yeah, they dosed themselves, didn't they? Which was a very classy move. And then I think it was running down batteries within a period of 30 minutes.
Right, they dosed themselves, and because of the way the registration code was written, it was just trying to connect. Like, if it didn't connect successfully, it would try again 5 seconds later. So there was no sort of exponential back off or anything like that. They just kept trying, and so the server just kind of fell over. And meanwhile, that making all those connections drains the battery, and people were reporting half an hour from full charge. But Had that not been the case, had there been a more robust server, or if they had pushed it down to only certain users at a time, you could definitely see a case where nobody would have even realized that was happening.
I can see you now stroking that long-haired white cat there, Chris. Now, in terms of the figuring out your stealthy technique, WAP push, is it only the telco, is it only your upstream provider who can actually do that sort of shenanigan, or is it possible for people to get, to actually start pushing these sorts of files to BlackBerries that are, on a different network?
I believe the only one that's capable of pushing down software, I believe, would be the carrier.
Yeah.
And again, if you're on an enterprise, then your enterprise admin could push down stuff to you. As far as anybody else, the only way for me to get software installed is if I visit a website or any of these app stores that are out there, and just like anything else, click on the link.
Yeah.
And it tries to download the
Yes, please. I would like the Dancing Bear screensaver. I would like that.
You want to install? Yes.
Yes. Do you want to install? Absolutely. What could possibly be harmful about dancing bears? I mean, they're dancing, for God's sakes. They're merry.
So friendly.
Yes, that's right. Now, Chris, I believe you did a bit of a technical analysis of we're just calling it a Trojan, really. I suppose they would call it of the lawful communications interception facilitation technology.
Now, we're going to call it spyware.
Spyware, okay. Now, what's interesting is not only did they send down a proprietary binary format that's like basically impossible to reverse, or just a real pain in the ass to reverse, they also sent down all of the source. They sent it down as a jar, right?
Yeah, they did. Normally, when an application installs on a BlackBerry, it's delivered as a COD file, which is it's a proprietary format. But some people have done some work kind of reversing that, and I think there's some information that you can get out of some of their patent filings that describe what the structure of that is. And it basically includes the signatures as well as a kind of an obfuscated form of the compiled classes. So it's not something that something that they don't release a lot of documentation on, but it has been reversed to some extent.
Mm.
But usually you just deliver that COD file and the BlackBerry installs it. For whatever reason, they also had the jar along with that. And not only that, the jar contained the classes that were not even obfuscated. So, if you were trying to protect your Java classes, you might run some additional code on that changes the function names and the method names and the variables to things that, don't necessarily make sense, encryption key and turns into like ABC or something. It just makes it hard for somebody to read, but it's still structurally valid and syntactically valid. But they didn't even do that. So with just an off-the-shelf Java decompiler, because they didn't obfuscate, everything was there just as it was originally when they built it. So it was very, very easy to sort of follow. They didn't do anything stealthy at all. I mean, it basically looks like that wasn't really a goal. There's all sorts of all sorts of strings in there, hard coded encryption keys. You can see exactly how messages are encrypted to devices and how they derive individual encryption keys based on the pins of the device. It's all sort of in there, so it doesn't really look like they made any attempt to hide what they were doing.
And Chris, what's your assessment of this software? I mean, you've had a chance to have a look at it. You've had a chance to pull it apart and get into its guts and see how it actually works. What do you think of it? Is it a bit spooky, or is it just like very run-of-the-mill stuff that you'd expect to find in this sort of application?
Well, we're just starting to look at mobile malware. And like I said, the reason that we were sort of interested in this from the start is because with some of the application scanning that we do, we look for backdoors, and data exfiltration is something that we're sort of interested in. Just from a general perspective, we look for that in sort of enterprise applications or off-the-shelf applications, because people want to know, is my software doing things that it shouldn't be? So we're in the process of extending that to look at mobile applications as well, not only on BlackBerry, but also on Windows Mobile and platforms like that. So we're starting to look at and this is why this is such a good example, because it was real, it was in the wild, it's not something cooked up in the lab, and we can kind of look and see, okay, well, are they doing it the way that we think people would be doing it, using the same APIs that we expect them to use, and so on. So that's kind of why we're interested. And we didn't really pull it apart to the extent that you would if you were really figuring out all the nuts and bolts. We probably spent about maybe a couple hours just kind of looking at it and following the code and seeing which path led to where. But we really haven't done sort of an intense look at it yet. We'll come back to it as we continue to develop scans for mobile malware, and it's going to be a good sort of a good test case for us to look back on every once in a while.
And did it behave as you expected it to?
Yeah, for the most part, it did. I mean, with BlackBerry, you can hook into various locations. So this one, hooked into sort of as a folder listener. So anytime something gets added or deleted from a folder, such as an email or a text message, then basically any class that implements that sort of interface will have its code called. So that's exactly the way we saw expected to be hooked in. There are not really many ways that you can kind of hook into the process like that because of the way that RIM is architected. You can't just go directly to the lower levels. You have to kind of use their API. Mm. So in terms of the way that they implemented it, yeah, it was pretty similar to what we expected. They had some methods that they weren't using for sending out copies of mail via SMTP. The one that looked like it was active in the code path was sending it out via HTTP. But on the SMTP one, which was apparently latent code, they had like an APN hard coded in there, so it would use that particular carrier's network as opposed to sending through the default. If you just told the device to send an email, it would send through whatever carrier it was currently connected to. But this one had an APN hard coded. I don't know what BBT.AE is. I should have looked that up. But basically, it had a kind of a roundabout way of sending out data. So that was interesting to see that and see that they kind of tried to avoid exfiltrating through the normal channels. But ultimately, not a extremely tricky thing to do. It's just kind of interesting more than anything.
Finally, Chris, would you expect that this type of software could find its way onto devices in developed nations? I mean, I wouldn't imagine that they'd send it out to all devices in a country like Australia or Britain or the US or New Zealand, but they're just the English-speaking countries that I can think of off the top of my head. But you could imagine that perhaps law enforcement agencies are already using this as in a more targeted way. I mean, is that far-fetched?
I don't think it's that far-fetched. The thing is that they wouldn't have any good way for that to be persistent on the device, and that's the same problem that I guess the UAE carrier is dealing with here. Once people know it's on there, and it's pretty easy, even outside of this case, to just go and compare the list of installed applications, against what you expect to be there. People can just go remove it, so you'd have to keep sending it down to them. And I think they would get a notification every time, so people might start to get a little bit worried. Now, there may be stealthier ways to do it than a WAP push, and that's something we haven't really looked into.
But come on, you WAP push this thing to some idiot drug dealer, right? Because they're not PhDs, okay, these guys. you WAP push it to them, they go, oh, my BlackBerry's not going to work if I don't install that, though. And then they hit the button, right? And then you've got all of their emails, and then you can send them to prison where they can't sell crack to teenagers anymore, right? And that's good. So perhaps the only reason we know about this is because it was so widespread. If this is being done in a targeted way towards certain people, where an interception warrant has already been granted, they're likely to be dodgy people. I can't see that this is just something that's new, that's popped up in the UAE. To me, this strikes me as something that law enforcement agencies have probably been doing for a while.
I mean, it seems like a technical possibility for sure. I mean, this whole, like I said, this company, SS8, doesn't look like, at least from their website, it doesn't look like a garage operation. I mean, they sell, software for intelligence and law enforcement, and clearly they must have some customers, and they're probably doing, I would imagine they're doing similar things for other carriers. How those carriers are using it, it's pretty hard to say to what extent they're doing it, but they've got to be, this company and other companies writing this sort of stuff, and it's certainly not unique to BlackBerry. So,
Well, I suppose really we never really write anything in an email that we wouldn't put on a postcard anyway. So it's I guess it's to be expected.
Of course not.
Well, Chris Eng, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business, and we'll chat to you again soon, I'm sure.
Great, thanks for having me.
Chris Eng of Vericode there with a look at BlackBerry spyware. And incidentally, RIM, or Research in Motion, has come out and said they had nothing to do with the application. So I don't think they're particularly happy about this or really feel like being associated with it in a major way. Anyway, next up, it's time for our sponsor interview, and that's going to involve a chat with Paul Duck-a-Duck Ducklin, who does work for Sophos. He's joining us to discuss Form, an ISP advertising concept that has stirred up a bit of controversy. The idea behind Form's WebWise service was to deliver targeted advertising to ISP users based on their surfing habits, almost like a pop-up Trojan would do, but more intelligent, and this doesn't require any installed agent on your system. I personally would give this service a miss. But apparently British Telecom trialed the system in 2006 and 2007 without any consent being sought from the trial users, and that backfired on them pretty badly. So if you do a Google News search for Form with a PH, you'll see a lot of stories about ISPs and other companies opting out of this thing. Anyway, Paul joined me for his thoughts, and I started off by asking him to explain in his terms exactly what Form is.
I've been worrying about how to describe it in a way which isn't, you know, too positive or too negative. So if you'll excuse some sort of marketroidistic jargon, this is the definition I came up with. It is a precisely targeted demographic marketing and marketing intelligence system which works by packet sniffing.
Ah, so it's like a cross between an IDS and Google Ads.
Yes, except that what happened in the UK is it seems that British Telecom, no less, decided that this would be a great way of basically sniffing your and my traffic, HTTP traffic, working out what we liked, and then bombarding us with information that probably would have suited us really well. The problem is that they apparently did a trial of this system and they forgot to tell anybody that they were going to start doing this.
Oops.
Yes, so that I think got a vocal minority who figured, you know what, this is going too far. Probably even if you do have an opt-in, it's just a crazy thing for a major ISP to associate itself with.
Well, it strikes me as being interesting in that, you know, we've seen a number of bits of spyware that come out that are designed to sort of target ads and do things like that. And of course, we all jump up and down and point our finger at them and say, these guys are really bad. Yet it's a reputable ISP like BT is prepared to do this by packet inspection instead of actually deploying some sort of bit of spyware to the client PC. And somehow that's supposed to be okay. What the?
I think the flip side of that is if they had said, to opt into this, you need to install this, you know, packet sniffing device on your computer, which will redirect the packets to our market intelligence sniffing system. Would that make it any better? I mean, I don't think that the industry in general would think that it would make it better. If you look at what happened to the market score guys with their ComScore program back in 2001, 2002, I think it was, that did exactly that. These guys weren't an ISP, so they couldn't just sniff the traffic. They had to get your traffic diverted through their servers. And they did that with a little agent on your endpoint, which sort of diverted the traffic, you know, for your browsing pleasure. Of course, when you're on the endpoint, it makes a man-in-the-middle attack really trivial because you're not in the middle, you're at one end. And so those guys even went as far as sniffing inside things like your shopping basket so they could work out what you were buying. And this was done with your consent, but nevertheless, people reacted to it by saying, hey, you know what, we'd better withdraw that consent if we've given it because this is going far too far.
Yeah, look, that just seems a little bit nuts. But what do you think BT were thinking?
It's hard to say because I don't think they're going to tell you now. If you look at the new website they've got, there are these cool videos explaining, you know, what a fantastic idea it is. The sales pitch behind it appears to be that it's kind of like a search engine, but where you don't have to initiate the searches. In other words, it sort of organically learns from what you're interested in online, does the searches behind the scenes for like sites, and then starts letting you know, hey, there are other articles in this newspaper which might be of interest given what you've browsed for the last 5 or 10 minutes. So it kind of sounds cool to someone going, you mean that as I'm browsing, instead of having to keep stopping and flipping over to a Google search tab and find some stuff and then click on, this will sort of organically grow according to my interests. It sounds okay when it's put that way, but it seems that obviously the flip side of it, the way they generate money, is that they can then take that information about who's interested in what. I don't know how they make it anonymous if they know who's interested in what, and then go and sell that to websites saying, hey, when this guy browses, he's probably going to be much more interested in, say, Australian rules football than he is in cricket. So, you know, pump him, and he supports such and such a club, and you know, lives at 16 Acacia Avenue, Footscray, or something like that. So it does sound a bit crazy that it's supposed to be anonymous, and yet it can deliver this sort of specially targeted stuff just for you.
Mm. But, I mean, isn't this the sort of thing that people buy AV solutions to stop spyware getting onto their system that does that sort of thing?
Pretty much, and it's, you know, it's the sort of thing that we look out for when we're doing what you might call the legitimate side of packet inspection.
Mm.
We look out for HTTP traffic, which appears to be directing you to a site that may not be exactly what it seems, such as an anonymizing proxy or, you know, a rogue site, or, you know, a fake clone site, phishing site, and so forth. So I suppose from the form guys' point of view, that the WebWise guys, they figure, hey, look, packet sniffing of web traffic has become sort of de rigueur in businesses, and people use it to keep security stuff out and to regulate who's allowed what on the internet and make sure that you can do as much YouTube as you want at lunchtime but not in other hours. Why can't we use this for good and actually use it to optimize, you know, not for security purposes, but to optimize people's browsing? What was clear is that they're sniffing your traffic. They claim in some anonymous way, so they claim that they recognize things that they probably ought not to collect, like passwords and credit card numbers and, you know, your mother's maiden name and all of that stuff. I don't know how they do that and whether that will be accurate enough. And then whether or not they, you know, have used pop-ups or they have a portal page of yours that is magically populated, that's not made clear. It doesn't really matter because there, you know, there are 20 different ways of implementing that. The issue is that they're learning inside the fabric of the ISP's network what each of the users like. And the problem to me, it just seems really strange to imagine that this can be done to keep your privacy and your anonymity correctly whilst targeting you specifically. It just seems to beg a belief.
Well, we all remember what happened when that AOL search data wound up hitting the internet when, you know, they said they'd anonymized it because they scrubbed out all the IPs. But, you know, people have been doing vanity searches and things like that, and there was all those sad little things in there, like the widow who would Google for things, AOL search for things like loneliness and things like that. And then there was that really creepy user who was like looking for body mold and then, you know, how to get rid of bodies and things like that. It was a little bit unusual, to say the least. But yeah, I mean, it certainly was the case where they thought if they scrubbed the IPs and got rid of card numbers and stuff like that, it would be fine. But of course, it's very easy to identify people by their search terms, just for an example.
This is proved by sort of other sort of statistical analyses of data that you'd imagine is largely anonymous. I know somebody did a paper recently where they'd taken GPS data without any idea who it was, of people who decided, hey, I'll publish my geolocation at any time. And by virtue of the speeds at which the people were moving and the times at which the high-speed motion happened and whatever, they think this was in LA or in the Bay Area in San Francisco. They were able to work out which parts of the GPS data represented the person's daily commute, which meant that with a little bit of analysis over a relatively short period of time, they were pretty much able to work out where the person, whoever they were, worked, and thereby where they lived. And, you know, then you add to that the time, then you figure that guy's the guy on the night shift. And suddenly they realize that actually this data is in no way anonymous whatsoever. You know, we've got the computing power to sort of reconstruct the originator of the data, even though they believe they've taken care to obscure it. So I agree with you that, you know, just masking out IP numbers, and there's still a debate about whether those even represent personally identifiable information, just by removing IP numbers does not really obscure your, or, you know, guarantee your privacy.
So what's actually happened to Form now? I believe the trial has been abandoned. They've changed their name. I mean, are these guys going to slip into obscurity, or are they still out there actively trading and trying to get ISPs on board?
Well, their website, which is the top hit when you're searching Google, you know, this WebWise thing, it talks about WebWise Discover Beta, and we know that betas are perpetual these days. But when you click on some of the videos, it's very much using the sort of future subjunctive. In other words, they're talking about this service will be or it may be. So it looks as though they haven't found a willing buyer yet.
Paul, do you think it's inevitable that these sorts of services will eventually creep in, or do you think this is just folly?
Personally, I wouldn't tolerate it for a moment, so I would never opt in. And I'm glad that at least one conclusion that came out of this is that this is essentially unconscionable to do without opt-in. The problem is that a lot of people do seem to be willing to opt in and even to put in a lot of effort on their own part to give away information which they ought to be keeping private. You know, you only have to look at the sorts of information that people will willingly and openly give up on Facebook, which they probably wouldn't tell to you in the pub the first time they met you face to face. So people may try it and find, hey, this is really brilliant, and without perhaps thinking about the long-term consequences, consider that, you know, the price of this free service, namely that this aggregator and packet sniffer is learning something about them, in ways that they perhaps can't control or understand, they may figure that that price is one well worth paying. I would recommend against it, but other people may find it useful. That's the problem. Who can say?
So personally, that's your problem with this service then, is that company will be collecting a large amount of data that gives them a little bit too much insight into those internet users?
Yes, I guess it depends on their terms and conditions and how much one trusts them to stick vigorously to those terms and conditions. Are they only sniffing HTTP traffic? Are they looking at all your traffic and having a look at, hey, he's doing this, he's visiting this HTTP site at the same time that he's doing an FTP download from Venezuela, at the same time he's having an instant messaging chat with, you know, ooh, this particular other person who has authorized us to say who they are. I just think it just seems a little bit like the rather unpopular internet filtering plan that the current government have in mind, made to look really cool and done on an enormous scale in a way that is supposed to benefit you in untold ways. There just seem to be too many unsure variables for one really to decide whether or not this is a good or bad idea. And in that case, I suggest that it's vital to err on the side of caution and say, till further notice, this is a bad idea.
Okay, well, Paul, I think that's a good place to leave the discussion, mate. Thank you very much for joining us again on Risky Business, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Patrick. So we had a bad start. So we
wanted to came too strong and I stopped it all up. Paul Ducklin from Sophos there in this week's sponsor interview. And Sophos has a bunch of clever people like Paul in Australia. So, well, there's only one Paul Ducklin, let's be real, but they do have some very clever people in their offices. So if good support is what you're looking for from your AV provider, then they are definitely worth a look. And that's it for this week's show. Don't forget to check out Risky Business 2, our other podcast, and you can find the feed for that one at risky.biz/feeds. And this week you'll be hearing on Risky Business 2 an interview with Deviant Ollam about lockpicking, which was prepared by Risky.biz correspondent Paul Craig. I'll leave you now with this track called Bad Start by Peregrine, a Sydney band fronted by a very talented IT journalist, Brett Winterford. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Have a good one. I ain't going nowhere. I mean, what they call enhanced interrogation techniques in the USA, they call that tickling in that part of the world. They call it the tickles. That's what they call it. That's fun. That's horsing around.